Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. One of my favorite suttas, discourses that the Buddha gave, is called the Rohitasa Sutta. And he says that it is within this fathom-long body, with its thoughts and perceptions, that you will find the world, the origin of the world, the ceasing of the world, and the path that leads to the ceasing of the world. In this fathom-long body with its thoughts and perceptions lies the world, the origin of it, the ceasing of it, and the path that leads to the ceasing of it. And so what is the world that we construct through thoughts and perceptions? The Buddha calls this the world of samsara. The world of suffering, of stress, of dis-ease, discontentment that is constructed through, oftentimes, through thoughts and perceptions. Right? Like one of my favorite quotes I say a lot in here, Mark Twain said, the worst moments in my life never came true. Right? It's this suffering, it's this stress that's constructed, this world of reactivity, of impulse, of craving, of dissatisfaction, of restlessness and discontent. Right? This is the world that's constructed, he says, in this fathom-long body with our thoughts and perceptions. And fortunately, the Buddha didn't just leave us with the problem. He said, but it's also in this body, in this fathom-long body with its thoughts and perception, that lies the path that leads to the end of our mental suffering. And so, again, this isn't a theological assertion that there's suffering and that you're born into it and, you know, some metaphysical claim that you need to practice some dogma to free yourself from it. But really, it's a psychological inquiry. The Buddha was a psychologist. He wasn't interested in ontology, the nature of reality. He was interested in psychology, which is how we construct reality through thoughts. And this is interesting because it's a spiritual tradition. In the West, we're so used to orthodoxy. We're so used to someone just telling us how it is, and a lot of us don't like that anyway. And in a way, this makes Buddhism, to me, a personal opinion, more empowering, but also more difficult to practice. Because it's up to me to inquire deeply into the nature of suffering in my mind. So it's a pragmatic invitation to examine, here in the sutta, the fact that the mind is extremely powerful. That's what he's saying, I feel like. The mind is extremely powerful. And it's powerful, I think, for two reasons. One is your perceptions, the mind. The mind's perceptions construct our worldview. And our worldview can be described as our outlook on life, our ideological perspectives, how we make sense out of our role, out of our place in society, our views on politics and governance, our ethical codes and responsibilities. Right? These are worldviews. So the mind's very powerful because it has lots of views. The Buddha calls this the thicket of views. Lots of views in the mind, and the mind is very powerful because our minds harness movement, motivational power, the power of intention, which is the internal movement that directs our speech and action. So not only do our thoughts color our views, but our views inform how we act. Right? And our mind, our actions, start with our motivations, right? Everything that we speak and every way that we act and behave in the world starts with some inner movement. And so the mind is incredibly powerful. And last week, if you were here, I talked about how we use the mind through mindfulness, through intention, which I'm going to talk about tonight, through mental training, through ethics, through community, through all of our human faculties, how we use the mind to harness motivation that is skillful, that leads to our welfare and the welfare of others. We train the mind in skillfulness. Right? And that we can do this through the power of mindfulness and through really the path that the Buddha is offering for us to explore. And so one of the things I talked about last week was the role of faith in spiritual practice. And I use the word spiritual lightly, you know, because spiritual, I think, by definition means something like of the spirit. And, you know, we maybe go to this idea of spirits and maybe metaphysics, but really of the spirit of something. And everything's in the spirit of something, or a lot of things are at least, especially humanistic philosophy and psychology. They're in the spirit of well-being. The Buddha's teaching's all in the spirit of well-being. So spiritual practice is a practice that's in the spirit of well-being. And faith is essential. As much, I called it last week, the F word, as much as I struggle with this idea of faith, it's such an important part of what... It's a form of intention, really. It's a motivational aiming that keeps us on a spiritual path. Right? So it's an intention. And it's an action. Faith, I talked about last time, kind of four qualities of faith. They're all overlapping. One is faith is an attitude. Right? Like, faith is an attitude that has some optimism about our capacity to grow. Like, if I didn't believe that mindfulness has some capacity, if I didn't believe that it had something that could enrich my human experience to help alleviate impulsivity, reactivity, stress, and suffering, then I wouldn't do it. So faith has this kind of optimism that there are things out here in this world that can enrich my life and help with transformation. So faith is an attitude. Faith is also a direction, right? Like, we also have to take direction in something, having faith in, right? That's where we talk about having faith in. We have faith in a lot of things, whether my atheist ass likes it or not. Well, I have faith in a lot of things. I have faith in my car every morning, right? And then when the car breaks down, it's like, oh, man. Right? And the Buddha's not asking us to have faith in these impermanent, temporary, worldly things, right? But he's asking us to have faith in a path, right? To have faith in a system of forms, wise view and intention, wise speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration. These are eightfold path of practice. So faith is also direction, having some confidence in a path or many paths that lead us towards growth. I also talked a little bit how faith is also a motivating force. So faith is that energy that moves us forward on the path. It's the you can do it. It's the encouragement. And we're going to talk about this later in this determination, but it's this kind of like a resolution to keep going. And then I talked about faith as perseverance. Once we step onto a path, how do we keep going? And that's the hard part, I think. It's one of the things I see in my own practice. Fortunately, I have to come every week and give the Dharma talk, and I'm the guiding teacher here. So it's by design, my faith in the path, having accountability and having to be here, having a service commitment, it keeps me persevering. I can't be so sure that I wouldn't have cashed in my chips a little while ago if I hadn't had this accountability of sangha, of community, of, you know, the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, of my own personal practice. So tonight I want to just keep going with this and hopefully have some discussion and talk, almost take a step back from faith and just talk about intention. Like, what does it mean to live intentionally? Right? And we talk about that, and it's such a key role of mindfulness, is having more intentionality
throughout our day, in the ways that we speak and act, like being aware of what we're doing while we're doing it, like checking our motivations behind things and being really clear about what actions we put out into the world. Because in behavioral psychology, they say whatever you practice, you get better at. You practice sport, you get better at it. Language, you get better at it. You practice obsession, worry, and fear, and greed, and all these things that are unconscious habits of the mind. They get strong. They get rooted. And the Buddha said this too. I'll talk about it a little bit later. But he said that whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. Right? Whatever we frequently fill our attention with, our attention's going to want to go back there. And so having intention means being more aware of where our attention is in the moment and being able to practice living in line with our values, in line with our path of wanting well-being for ourselves. We want to live in line with that commitment, right, that we've made. And that takes moment-to-moment practice, and we will never do it perfectly, and we will fuck up a lot. And that's a part of the path. Like, that's a part of the cycle of the practice. So the Buddha said that the whole of our life, the whole of his path of teaching, rests on the tip of intention. One of the fascinating things about the way that the Buddha taught is that he took common ideas of his day and he redefined them. He kind of, in a way, appropriated certain ideas of his time, and he changed the meaning. In the Vedic, the early Indian school of thought, there was this concept or idea of karma, and karma means action. Karma also meant duty. So a lot of these early Indian practices were aimed at upholding duties through action, like rituals or ceremonies, right? To build merit so they could please the harmony of the world, so eventually they could be born and merge with God, basically, Brahma. And the Buddha took this idea and he shifted it and into a more psychological and less theological sense. And he said, well, karma is not so much action. It is action through speech and through behavior. He said, but karma really rests on the tip of your mind. Your karma, your momentum, your world is constructed through thought. And what you do up here, what you do on a daily basis, where our mind goes and what it engages in, constructs our world. And so he said, we want to be really careful. He used this word, yoniso manasikar, careful with our attention. And so he gave us the skill of mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is attributed to the Buddha. And this is really his unique offering in the Vedic kind of traditions of his time, was this practice of mindfulness, which gives us the ability to monitor the inner movements that create outer actions. It's what gives us, I think, and this would be a big philosophical discussion, which I wouldn't dare to get into, but I think mindfulness is what gives us the power of free will, if that exists. And I mean this very simply, is we've all had moments where we've wanted to react, and in that moment we made the decision to act differently than our impulse, right? We've all had moments where, like, we wanted to say the thing that we knew we'd probably regret later, and we had that moment where we just kind of, like, stopped dead in our tracks and took a different route. That's a moment of mindfulness. That's a powerful moment. And the Buddha's saying, really, we can cultivate more of these moments, more moments of awakening, right? More moments of awakening over time create greater awakening, more clarity, more wisdom, more discernment, less reactivity, more responsibility, taking responsibility for the inner movements and having the ability to respond. And so we've all had moments where we notice an impulse to react and made a decision to act differently. Mindfulness enables us to do this. This is really the core practice that the Buddha taught that gives us the power of free will, the ability to choose our response. And so I want to talk a little bit about what does neuroscience say about our perceptions, thoughts, and motivations? What does neuroscience say about the power of our mind, how we think, how we perceive, and how we're motivated to act? First, some neuroscientists have studied what they call the default mode network of the brain. And what the default mode network is it means basically when at rest, I'm not a neuroscientist, so I speak about these things as plainly as I can understand them, but I think they give validity to a lot of what we're trying to do here, so it's important. But the default mode network means that it's a network of neural pathways in the brain, let's just say that, that when at rest, when you're at rest, the mind is by default still engaged in active thinking. Okay? So when we're at rest, the mind is still engaged in active thinking. The default mode network is active during passive rest, which usually involves thinking about others. This is the thinking that comes up automatically. Thinking about oneself, the thinking that comes up automatically. Remembering the past and envisioning the future, rather than being available for whatever tasks are being performed, right? Or in a static state of non-mental activity. So the mind, when left to its own device, is thinking. Another thing that neuroscience knows about the mind is that in a study by a guy named Killingsworth and Gilbert, they say that a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. So not only does your mind wander, all right, that's the first part, the default mode, it's active, that when it wanders, we find out that we're overwhelmingly, on average, unhappy when the mind's wandering. They notice that even when the people in this study were thinking about something positive, pleasant, they were still, on average, unhappy, more unhappy than people that were present with the task they were accomplishing in the moment. And the way they studied this is they surveyed people, 5,000 people from different countries. They made an app on the iPhone and a way to be able to target people in the moment to ask this kind of survey of what they were doing, whether they were present with the task at hand, and how they were feeling in the moment. So we know that the mind wanders. We know that the wandering mind is an unhappy mind. And we know that when not wandering or wandering, the mind's attention tends to have a negative bias. So that means that even in the present, our attention is scanning or most easily stimulated by negative stimuli. So it pays attention mostly to uncomfortable things. So I'll read a little bit of what Rick Hansen says about this. He says that your body generally reacts more intensely to negative stimuli than to equally strong positive stimuli. He says that negative stimuli produce more neural activity than do equally intense positive stimuli. Negative stimuli are also perceived more easily and more quickly by the brain. For example, people in studies can identify angry faces faster than happy ones, even if they're shown these images so quickly, just a tenth of a second or so, that they cannot have any conscious recognition of the faces. The ancient fight or flight limbic system of the brain will still get activated by the angry faces. The alarm bell of your brain, which is the amygdala, uses about two-thirds of its neurons to look for bad news. It's primed to go negative. Once it sounds the alarm, negative events and experiences get quickly stored in memory, in contrast to positive events and experiences, which usually need to be held in awareness for a dozen or more seconds to transfer them from short-term memory to long-term storage. Right? So that means that not only do we scan for negative stimuli, but we're more affected by negative stimuli than positive stimuli. We store negative stimuli quicker into long-term memory than positive stimuli. And so the question is kind of this. When we're talking about intention, we're talking about the mind, what does having a wandering mind, an unhappy mind, and a negatively focused mind say about our motivations? What are we motivated to do? What does our neurobiology say about our day-to-day decision-making? I think it says that we unconsciously or consciously try to find happiness, to try to find rest in a mind that's restless, and try to get rid of discomfort a lot of the time. And so the Buddha calls this perpetual wandering. He says that the untrained mind is a mind that's perpetually wandering. I love this metaphor. And this is what's really cool about reading a 2,600-year-old text, is that the Buddha didn't have neuroscience, right? So he uses metaphors and he uses terminology that go into great detail about our psychology, but he uses terms like this that kind of describe the default mode of the brain, perpetual wandering. And he says that the habits of the mind are to seek pleasure and avoid pain endlessly. And he calls this samsara. And the reason why this is suffering is because the world does not provide endless pleasure. Right? The world provides, as the Chinese Buddhists say, life is equally 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. Life is both pleasurable and painful. But when we have a brain and a system and a whole orientation to our world that demands the satisfaction of feeling comfort, that demands the satisfaction of feeling pleasure, right? In a mind that seeks the discomfort, we find ourselves miserable a lot of the time. The good news, the Buddha didn't leave us just with the nihilistic kind of perspective on the world and our hopeless state. He says that just simply by cultivating a deep attention, having more moments of awareness, we don't get so hijacked by the perpetual wandering, by the unhappy mind, and by the negativity bias. And so we can, with mindfulness, bring awareness into the movements of the mind, and we can reprogram the mind. You know? It doesn't mean that, and it definitely doesn't mean that the Buddha is saying, well, sit here and just try to focus on the positive. You know, the Buddha wasn't necessarily a proponent of the spiritual bypass, which is just avoid anything uncomfortable and focus only on the positive aspects of life. He says, no, we learn how to hold the discomfort with the compassionate, patient, understanding quality of awareness. And learn how to engage with it, to creatively engage with what's difficult, with forgiveness and with compassion and with care and empathy and understanding, right? To learn how to enjoy pleasure without having to dig our claws into it and squander the moments of pleasure just by needing them to last or fearing that they might go away. And this is what he called the middle path, which is between the extremes of indulgence and repression. That's a hard path to walk. Fortunately, I like to think of the middle path as like a meandering, right? It's not like a straight and narrow. But this path, this dharma, this mindfulness, these trainings, they are a path that help us to stay in the middle. And so there are three levels of living with intention, really, or functions of intention that the Buddha talked about, which I'll talk about for a few minutes, and then we can kind of discuss. The first is moment-to-moment intention, which is moment-to-moment decision-making. The Pali Sanskrit word is chetana. Chetana is a mental movement that guides the mind in a particular direction towards a specific object or goal. So chetana is just the feeling of, I call it the to-do mind. Sally Armstrong calls it the about-to movement. It's the mind in the moment that's about to do something, right? We all know those moments where we're about to say something, we're about to send an email, we're about to have the conversation or do the physical action or whatever it is. We're about to. So that's chetana, this volitional movement. It's an inner movement. And so in Buddhist psychology, this quality of chetana is a universal mental factor, which means that it's happening all the time. So your mind's always moving to do something about what it's experiencing. Right? It's always moving to do something about. And so we get to watch with really deep mindfulness, we start to watch what the mind's about to do. Right? We get to look into this movement, this moment to moment, and to choose, right, to make decisions to intervene, to make decisions to support the mind's inclination to do something. And this is one of the functions of intention. How do we practice with the urges to do? One of the things that we can do is we can undertake some ethical structure. Right? This is like a part of what we call sila in Buddhism, which is ethical training precepts, which are the precept to not intentionally cause harm, the precept to not intentionally take what's not freely offered to us, to refrain from engaging in sexual misconduct, right? To refrain from dishonesty, manipulative, harsh, divisive speech, right? To refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs that lead towards not having much mindfulness, right? So the Buddha says that these aren't rules, they're trainings. They're things that we really have to kind of cope with. It's like, if we want a mind that's inclined in more skillful ways, we have to have a mind that we protect through behavior. So that's one way that we work with the chetana, this to-do mind. We can also start to become aware of what we're motivated by in each moment. And this is just mindfulness. Looking at our unconscious bias, right? We are biased to do what's comfortable first, not our fault, what the mind does. So when I'm lonely, I don't like that feeling. What am I going to do? I'm going to want to text my ex, or I'm going to want to go, you know, to the fridge and figure out what I can do there to take care of it. I'm going to want to go, whatever I might want to do with my to-do, with the chetana, it's going to move. It's going to start to move out of that feeling. And so mindfulness is it's very radical, and this is the hardest sell, I think, but it's very true, is that we're really trying to turn the mind in and say, hold on a second, is it okay to just be with this feeling of loneliness right now? You know, and actually what we get to see is we can be, right? We can be with the loneliness, and we can nurture and care for it, and we can actually stop the loneliness from creating destruction in our lives. And then we can actually, if we think about it almost mathematically, like with loneliness, is if you actually bring attention and care and nurturing support to loneliness, it's no longer alone. So it's no longer going to need to go do destructive things because you're with it. The awareness is with it. So if I'm with loneliness, loneliness doesn't need anyone else. It doesn't mean we don't want relationships. We'll talk about that too, because that's part of what we want to practice is healthy relationships. You know, but part of this is turning in with mindfulness. We also take note of the to-do when our motivations spill out into destructive habits. We get an opportunity to feel what the Buddha calls the guardians of the universe, which are self-respect and moral responsibility, sometimes they're defined as, or conscious and concern, or traditionally, moral shame and moral dread. So he calls these the guardians, and we don't talk about shame in the old Pali text the same way we talk about it in the West. Shame is in a sense that something's wrong with me. Shame is a sense in here that what I have done with my to-do, the way that my actions have spilled out, are not conducive to social harmony, right? So like being able to have this sense of like community, you know, like wanting to live in line with communal harmony, like wanting to live and do things that we don't regret, that benefit the well-being of others. And these are the guardians of shame and regret, really. And so that's one kind of later step. If we miss the ethical integrity kind of slips, mindfulness slips, we act out, the to-do just comes out of us and does something, we get the blessing of having regret. Like, thankfully, I don't feel good about that. You know, instead of going into core shame, which is, I'm so bad, you know, I'm no good, I always screw up, which is just more suffering, we're able to actually say, oh, thankfully, I have that feeling. So these are some ways we work with Chaitanya, which is this just the movement of the mind that guides the mind in a particular direction towards a specific object or goal. The second, which I won't talk too much about because I mostly did last time, I believe the Pali word is aditana, which means resolution or determination, which is another function of intention. So intention is also a quality of endurance or a commitment that sustains our interest in this path, in moment-to-moment decision-making. So intention is like having an intention to keep going. Like I talked earlier with faith, those are all practices of this type of intention. Right? This is the type of intention that probably brought us here tonight. Why are we here? Well, we want something. We want something from this. We want community. We want to know about mindfulness. We want to learn more about Buddhism. Why? Well, because we have some determination to, there's some piece of us that wants something. Right? I would just call this generically, we want awakening. We want to wake up. We want to be free from suffering that's created when we fall asleep into the perpetual wandering. And so this is the intention of staying committed, holding steadfast to a path and to really seeking. I talked about last week as well, more about faith and faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. The Buddha being representative not of a man that lived 2,600 years ago, but Buddha is this potential for awakening, that each one of us has the ability to recover, to awaken, to have more clarity, more wisdom, more compassion, and that we want to aspire to live our highest self. Or non-self, if you've been coming a while. So we want to aspire to live our highest self. So that's the determination of the Buddha, to determine to live to our potential. The second is the Dharma, the refuge in the Dharma, which is a path. The determination to have some accountability to form, that we all have some structure, right? That we have... This is one of the things that if I look into my life, I think many of us can relate. We all want to do good, but why don't we? Well, because we sometimes lose form. We lose accountability, right? We lose, like, I want to go to the gym, but if I don't have a wake-up call, if I don't have someone waiting there for me sometimes, it's hard to go. And the Dharma is this path. The Dharma is this practice. So that's the path. And then the third is people. Determination is best inspired and brought into being through social relationships. Human beings are wired to connect. It's just as much of a part of our neurobiology as the negativity bias or anything else, is that we seek connection. And so what keeps us determined, what keeps our intention strong to keep going, it's other people. So I call this determination through intention, the intention of our potential, the Buddha, the intention of the path, the Dharma, and the intention of the people, the Sangha. The third and final, which I won't spend too much time on because it's a whole nother topic, but just talking about intention. The Buddha also talked about intention as wisdom factors. So these are almost like, it's a part of the Eightfold Path. It's something to live by, right? So these are intentions to live by. And there are three. Renunciation is the intention to live simply. Then there's the intention to live without causing harm. And then there's the intention to live with goodwill, loving kindness, kindness. And so I'll just give a little bit of kind of time to these three, and then we'll open it up. Renunciation is a key component of the Buddhist teaching, and it is somewhat unique to the Dharma in particular. It's something I feel like in our Western world that we butt heads with. Is really a large part of what the Buddha, the context in which the Buddha taught, was this renunciate lifestyle that was very popular in ancient India, which was one of leaving home, going into homelessness, as the Buddha says, and taking on a life of spiritual practice. Now, the Buddha didn't encourage everyone to do this, right? But true spiritual seekers, they did. And the Buddha had lay practitioners, lay followers, people that were interested in his teaching and living this middle path. Those are us that aren't monks and nuns, that aren't going to live at a monastery somewhere. We're living in the world. But he really strongly encouraged us to practice this principle, this intention, this wisdom factor of living simply. Right? Because our lives and the busyness of our lives overwhelm us. Right? Milan Kundera calls this the demon of speed. He says it overwhelms our ability to see, to hear, to stop, to wonder. Mindfulness is really hard to access when we're preoccupied with stuff. And so part of this is like spring cleaning. Like mindfulness is kind of in the Buddhist path and living with this intention of renunciation. It's like, what can I reduce the clutter of in my life? And to try to really go after that and to let go of some of the things that are just taking up space. For some of us, this could be material things. It could be scheduling things. It could be people that take up space. It could be, you know, simplifying how socially active we are in certain areas of our lives, like finding balance through renunciation. And the second and third, I can't even give close of enough face time to, but that's okay, is living with the intention of non-harming, non-cruelty, or compassion is another way to put this. To protect and uphold the blessing of life for ourselves and others, and to do this by, you know, practicing living a lifestyle that is environmentally understanding of the impacts of how we engage in consuming in our world, right? Living a lifestyle that understands that our actions have results. Right? And again, the Buddha actually didn't take any moral stances on this. He didn't actually say, you should be vegetarian. At no point in the discourses did he say that. At no point did he say, you should vote. Right? He never said, you should do any of this shit. But he did say that we want to uphold with deep intention the wisdom of non-harming. That's something to consider. Third and final, to practice living without resentment and hatred in the mind, right? To live in a mind, in a body that is gentle, right? He says to be wise and gentle in speech. He has a whole sutta on this called the Metta Sutta, which is the sutta or the discourse on loving kindness. And he says things like, this is what should be done by one who's skilled in goodness. He says, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble, not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened by duties, frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. And so he's really trying to give us a lot of examples of how to live with the wisdom of loving kindness. And this is just as much of a practice as anything else. And loving kindness is something we cultivate, develop in the mind. Ajahn Sumedho, a Thai forest monk, said that the path in Buddhism is not to follow the heart like it is in the West. He says to train the heart. Kindness is something that we don't have to believe in. It's something we've got to look for and do. Non-harming is not something to believe in. It's something to look for and to do. Right? And renunciation is not something to a stance that we take, a minimalist, you know, kind of postmodern stance to take on the world. It's a lifestyle to practice and to do. So this is a lot of stuff. If you come on Sunday nights, this tends to be my habit, is to just endlessly